home, and you three carry on without me. With the dogs, yes? Nobody wanted to be the first to agree.
We left poor Hugo an hour ago in the Sukkahus at Longyearbyen. Tomorrow he'll board the tourist yacht and head back to Tromsø. I'll miss him. I think we could have been friends.
I wish it was Fat Algy who'd broken his leg. Hugo didn't want us to stay, which was a relief, because in Longyearbyen I felt as out of place as the tourist from that yacht. God, what a dump! A ramshackle settlement of some 500 souls. It's all that's left of the great Arctic coal rush. A few decades ago, a clutch of prospectors reported huge deposits, and greed took over. Nations scrambling to stake claims, companies sprouting like mushrooms, raising millions on expectation alone. Must have gone bankrupt or were bought for a song by the Norwegians, who now run what remains. According to the books, Longyearbyen boasts electricity and water piped from a glacier, as well as a billiards hall and a bathhouse. What I saw were ugly miners' barracks cowering at the feet of stark grey mountains. A cable railway strung along their flanks like a grimy necklace, its buckets dumping coal on the jetty in clouds of black dust. A single street strewn with rubbish and mobbed by screaming gulls. A wooden church and a cluster of grave markers on a hill. On our way back to the ship, we passed a group of miners heading for town. One turned his head and stared at me. His face was black with soot, his eyes angry and inflamed. He looked scarcely human, capable of anything. I felt obscurely menaced and ashamed. It feels wrong that there should be such places on Spitsbergen. I'm glad Gruhuken is far away from all this. I don't want it sullied. 2nd of August, near Cape Mitra, northwest Spitsbergen. First Hugo, now this. Damn Ericsson. He's cast a pall over the whole expedition. And for what? He hasn't even given us a reason. This morning, Algy and I were on deck when Gus called us down to the saloon. We knew at once that something was wrong. Ericsson sat in stony silence, his hands spread flat on the table. Gus's face was set, his blue eyes glassy with anger. "Ah, gentlemen," he greeted us in clipped tones. "It seems that Mr. Ericsson here refuses to take us to Gruhuken." We stared at the skipper. He wouldn't meet our eyes. "He says," Gus went on, "that he'll take us as far as Raudfjord, but no further."
"But that's 40 miles short," cried Algy.
"And he says," continued Gus, "that these were always his orders, that he's never heard any mention of Gruhuken." The blatancy of the Norwegian's lie astonished me. And he didn't back down. In fact, he put up quite a fight. He insisted that he'd been chartered to take us to Raudfjord and no further. We said this was nonsense. Our goal had always been Gruhuken. He said there was good camping on Raudfjord. We pointed out that Raudfjord has no ice cap, and we'd hardly have gone to the trouble of bringing a sledge and 8 dogs if we didn't need them. He said he knew nothing of that. His ship had been chartered for Raudfjord, and to Raudfjord she would go. We reached stalemate. Algy muttered something irrelevant about legal action. Gus seethed. The Norwegian crossed his arms and glowered. Behind his granite demeanour, I sensed unhappiness. He hated reneging on his charter. So why was he doing it? Before I could say anything, Gus placed both palms on the table and leaned towards the skipper. His usual genial manner was gone. In its place, I saw the assurance which comes from generations of command. "Now look here, Ericsson," he said. "You will carry out the job for which you were hired. You will take us to Gruhuken, and there's an end of it." Poor Gus. Maybe that works on his father's estate, but not with a man like Ericsson. The Norwegian sat like a boulder, immovable. I decided it was my turn. "Mr. Ericsson," I said, "do you remember our first night on board? I asked you why you chose to overwinter on Spitsbergen,
and you said it's because there a man can breathe with both lungs. I took that to mean that you felt free. Free to make your own decisions. Was I right? He didn't reply, but I had his attention. Don't you see it's the same for us? I went on. We thought long and hard about where to site our camp, and we chose Gruhuken. We chose it. We made a decision.
You don't know what you are doing, he growled.
Now look here, cried Gus.
Oh, I say, exclaimed Algy at the same time.
Without taking my eyes from Erickson's, I signed them to silence.
What do you mean by that? You don't know, he repeated.
Then tell me, I urged him.
Come now, you're an honourable man, and yet you've gone back on your word. Why?
Why don't you want to take us to Gruhuken?
What's wrong with it?
His face darkened.
He glared at me.
For a moment, I thought he was going to tell me. Then he leapt to his feet and struck the table with both fists.
Hilvidesand, as you wish. To Gruhuken, we go.
3rd of August, off Gruhuken. There's some drift ice in the bay, but also plenty of open water, and Mr. Erickson has dropped anchor 100 yards from the beach. We wanted to go ashore and explore, but he said it was too late and the crew was tired. After yesterday's row, we thought it best to humour him. After dinner, I went on deck and listened to the ice talking to itself. I fancy it sounds different from the ice we encountered further south. Sterner. Harsher. But that's only my imagination. We had a clear run up the coast and round the northwest cape, although the weather remained overcast and foggy. As we headed east, our anticipation grew. Only a few miles left to go. Gus and Algy leaned over the side, counting off landmarks on the map. I went to the wheelhouse to make one last attempt with the skipper. Mr. Erickson, I began with a poor attempt at geniality.
Professor, he replied without taking his eyes from the sea.
I don't wish to offend you, I said carefully, and I'm not suggesting that you haven't been straight with us, but I'd count it a favour if you'd tell me, man to man, why you don't want to take us to Gruhuken. Still watching the waves, the Norwegian adjusted course. For a moment his glance flicked sideways to me. Something in his expression told me he was wondering if I could be trusted. Please, I said. All I want is the truth.
Why?
I was startled.
Well, isn't it obvious?
We'll be there a year. If there's some problem, we need to know about it.
Is not always good to know, he said quietly. I'm not sure I agree with you. I think it's always best to know the truth.
He gave me another odd look. Then he said,
some places, they make bad luck.
What? I was taken aback. What do you mean?
Gruhuken is bad luck. Things happen there.
What things?
Bad things.
But what? Tricky currents in the bay? Bad weather off the ice cap? What?
He chewed his moustache. There are worse things.
The way he said that, as if he couldn't bear to think of it. For a moment I was shaken, then I said,
but Mr. Erickson, surely you don't believe that a place, a mere pile of rocks, can make bad things happen. I didn't say that.
Then what? Another silence. Exasperated, I blew out a long breath. That was my mistake. His face closed, and I knew that I'd lost him.
Shouts from the deck. Gus and Algy were beaming and waving at me. Look, Jack, look!
While I'd been talking to the skipper, the weather had undergone one of those sudden Arctic reversals. The clouds had lifted, the fog had cleared. That first sight of it, like a blow to the heart, the desolation, The beauty! A fierce sun blazed in a sky of astonishing blue. Dazzling snow-capped mountains enclosed a wide bay dotted with icebergs. The water was as still as glass, mirroring the peaks. At the eastern end of the bay, tall cliffs the colour of dried blood were thronged with seabirds, their clamour muted by distance. At the western end, shining pavements of pewter rock sloped down to the sea, and a stream glinted at a tiny ruined hut huddled among boulders. The charcoal beach was littered with silver driftwood and the giant ribs of whales. Behind it, greenish-grey slopes rose towards the harsh white glitter of the ice cap. Despite the cries of gulls, there was a stillness about it, a great silence. And God, that light! The air was so clear I felt I could reach out and touch those peaks, snap off a chunk of that ice cap. Such purity! It was like heaven. For a moment I couldn't speak. I turned to Mr. Erickson. Is that... He nodded and sucked in his breath like a gasp.
Yeah. Gruhugen.
Chapter 5 7th of August, Gruhugen. Our fourth day at Gruhugen. I've been too exhausted to write. This morning we finished unloading the ship. That meant lowering 80 tons of supplies and dogs into the boats and rowing them ashore, except for the fuel drums which we floated into the shallows. I had an anxious time with my wireless crates. If anything gets wet, it'll be damaged beyond repair, but thank God they made it okay. Then I had to protect them from the dogs who were racing about christening things. And when a husky is loose, it eats whatever it finds. Windproofs, rucksacks, tents. It wasn't long before Gus and Algy saw sense and tied the brutes to stakes. At first they complained with ear-shattering yowls. Then they realized it was hopeless and settled down. I've enjoyed the hard work after being cooped up on the Isbjorn. Every night, these strange white nights that I still find magical, Mr. Erickson and the crew go back to the ship to sleep. But we're keen to take possession of Gruhugen, so we've pitched our pyramid tent on the beach at the head of the bay. Our reindeer-high ground sheets are supremely comfortable, and not even the seabirds keep us awake. We've been so busy that at times I've hardly noticed our surroundings, but sometimes I'll pause and look about. And then I'm sharply aware of all the busy creatures, men, dogs, birds, and behind them, the stillness, like a vast, watching presence. It's a pristine wilderness. Well, not quite pristine. I was a bit put out to learn that there have been others here before us. Gus found the ruins of a small mine on the slopes behind the camp. He brought back a plank with what looks like a claim, roughly painted in Swedish. To make the beach safe for the dogs, we had to clear a tangle of wire and gaffs and some large rusty knives, all of which we buried under stones. And there's that hut, crouched among the boulders in a blizzard of bones. Gus asked Mr. Erickson about it. So were there trappers here too, or was it the miners who left all the bones? Mr. Erickson sucked in his breath.
Yeah.
Gus raised his eyebrows.
Well, which?
The Norwegian hesitated. Trapper first, miners later. And after them no one, I said, not until us. Mr. Erickson did not reply. I'm glad to say that relations with him have improved, and he and his crew have worked like demons to help us set up camp. Almost, Gus remarked, as if they've a deadline to meet. And maybe they have. With every day that passes, the midnight sun dips nearer the horizon. In a week on the 16th, it'll disappear for the first time, and we'll experience our first brief night. Mr. Erickson calls it First Dark. Algy's planning a little ceremony involving whiskey to usher it in, but Mr. Erickson disapproves. He seems to think we shouldn't joke about such things. I've told the others what he said about Gruhookan being unlucky. Gus was briskly dismissive, and Algy said I shouldn't indulge the man's penchant for superstition. Secretly, though, I think they were relieved that it wasn't worse. I feel better, too. Now it's dealt with. Out in the open. This morning, after the last crate was brought ashore, the Isbjorn set off on the 40-mile trip to collect our boat's coal and the materials for the cabin. It's good to be on our own. A sort of dress rehearsal, and it's given us a chance to explore. Leaving the dogs tied to their stakes, Algy took his rifle and headed off to hunt, while Gus and I went for a wander to the bird cliffs at the eastern end of the bay. The weather has been perfect since we arrived, and this was another brilliant windless day, surprisingly warm in the sun, only just below freezing. The sea was a vivid blue, mirroring the mountains, and out in the bay I spotted three bearded seals basking on ice floes. I took deep breaths of the clean, salty air, and it went to my head, like wine. Nearer the cliffs, the smell of guano took over. We scrambled among the rocks, Gus pausing now and then to identify yellow Arctic poppies and brilliant green clumps of saxifrage. He's fascinated by nature, and likes pointing things out to me, the ignorant physicist. I don't mind. I quite enjoy it. The cliffs echoed with the guillemot's rattling groans. Craning my neck, I saw the sky speckled black with birds like dirty snow, thousands more perched on ledges. In the shadow of the cliffs, the dark green water was dotted with white feathers. Among them paddled guillemot chicks, fluffy and flightless. They rode the waves, uttering high, piercing cries. "Poor little scraps," said Gus. "They spend their first 3 weeks on a ledge facing the wall. Then they jump off, and if they're lucky, they hit the water and swim out to sea with their parents." "If they're lucky," I remarked. "I'd just seen a gull swoop down and swallow a chick whole." "Not much of a life, is it?" said Gus. 3 weeks with your beak jammed against a rock, then you jump off and get eaten." A lone chick was bobbing on the swell, peeping. Maybe it had got separated from its parents, or maybe they'd been taken by the Arctic foxes which haunt the feet of the cliffs like small grey ghosts. As we made our way round the headland, we heard the distant report of Algy's rifle. We watched a big thuggish gull bullying a guillemot into disgorging its fish. Gus found a reindeer skull and showed me its worn-down teeth. He said it would have died of starvation, albeit with a full stomach, as it could no longer chew its food. Sitting on the rocks, we basked in the sun, and I thought about the beauty and cruelty around me. Without preamble, Gus said, "The other day, I didn't express myself very well. What I was trying to say is that I don't think you've missed your chance." I felt myself going red. "What I mean," he went on, "is that although your family had a hard time of it, that needn't drag you down too." "It already has," I muttered. "I don't accept that. You're here. This is a new beginning. Who knows what it'll lead to?" "That's easy for you to say," I retorted. "But Jack, Gus, leave it. I came out here to get away from my life, not rake it all up, okay?" I'd spoken more sharply than I intended, and there was an uncomfortable silence. I shredded a clump of Arctic poppies. Gus counted the tines on the reindeer's antlers. Then he said, "Back in London, did you really not have any friends?" I shrugged. "Everyone I knew at UCL was doing further degrees. Why would I want to see them? And I got nothing to say to the lads at Marshall Gifford. So I just thought, sod it. I'll go it alone." His lip curled. "You're so extreme." "No, I'm not," Yes, you are. How many people do you know who've spent 7 years entirely on their own?
Well, since I don't know any people, the answer is none.
He laughed. That's what I mean. Extreme. I bit back a smile.
And after all that, to end up stuck in a tent with Algy and me?
He hesitated.
Tell me honestly. Is it a strain?
I threw away the poppies and looked at him. Sunlight glinted in his golden hair and lit the strong, clean planes of his face. He wasn't merely good-looking. His features had a chiseled purity that made me think of Greek heroes. I wondered what it must be like to be so handsome. Surely it would affect the behavior of everyone around you, always. And more powerful even than his looks, he seemed genuinely to want to know how I was getting on.
Honestly, I said, it's not as bad as I expected.
On the way back, a fulmar glided overhead, so low that I heard the hiss of air beneath its wings. Fulmars are serene grey seabirds, which Gus says are first cousins of the albatross.
I watched this one skim the waves till it was out of sight. As we headed past the cliffs, I heard that guillemot chick still peeping. I wished something would eat it and get it over with. At camp, we found Algy in high spirits. He'd made his way west into the next fjord, where he'd come upon a spit of land crammed with eider ducks. He'd shot 5, and on his return he'd bagged a seal, which he'd hacked to pieces and fed to the dogs. Judging by the amount of blood spattered on the rocks, it had been a big seal, and Algy is a messy butcher. For dinner, we roasted the ducks on a driftwood fire, having, on advice from the ship's cook, removed the fishy-smelling skin. They were the best thing I've ever tasted. We washed up in sand and seawater, then lay about smoking and drinking whiskey. We had a long discussion about whether Amundsen was a greater explorer than Scott, and where did Shackleton fit in, and was Nabile a cad or a decent fellow? Everyone looks tousled and tanned, and our beards are becoming quite respectable. Algy's is red and fuzzy like a hedge. Gus's is golden, of course. It suits him, inordinately. He says mine makes me look like a pirate. I suppose he means because I'm dark. I never expected to get on with him like this. Okay, sometimes Algy gets on my nerves. He's obtuse and he snores, and he takes up so much space. But I'm beginning to regard Gus as a friend. He's quite persuasive, too, is Gus? All that talk about new beginnings. I nearly believed him. It hurt. Like pulling off a scab. I'm writing this in our tent. Outside it's -5, but in here, with our eider-down sleeping bags and Gus's fur motoring rug on top, it's quite snug. The tent's green canvas walls are softly aglow in the white Arctic night. There's an occasional yelp from the dogs, but they're tethered 100 yards away and full of seal, so it's not too bad. I can hear the little waves sucking at the shingle, and the muted cries of seabirds. And now and then there's a crack as an iceberg breaks apart in the bay. The day after tomorrow, the Isbjorn is due back, and we'll start building our cabin. I never expected this, but I feel at home here. I love Gruhooken. I love the clarity and the desolation. Yes, even the cruelty. Because it's true. It's part of life. I'm happy. 8th of August. A strange day. Not altogether good. After breakfast, we decided to take a proper look at Gruhooken's ruins, so that when the Isbjorn returns, we'll know what needs clearing away. To my annoyance, Algy brought the dogs. So far I've managed to ignore them, and they've sensed my dislike and given me a wide berth. Another bright day.
almost hot in the sun as we climbed the slopes to inspect the ruined mine. Gus and me striding ahead, Algy puffing in the rear. I was relieved to see that there isn't much left of the mine. A rusty tram car, a stack of tracks, a few hollows blasted from the rocks.
"No cabins," remarked Algy.
"I asked Erickson about that," said Gus. "He says they were buried in a rock slide." Algy grimaced.
"Poor chaps."
"Oh, the miners weren't in them, but it was the last straw and they abandoned the place."
"What do you mean, the last straw?" said Algy.
"What does it matter?" I snapped. "They couldn't make a go of it, so they left, and that's that."
"Steady on, old chap," said Algy, turning pink beneath his freckles.
I was damned if I was going to apologize. I hate all this raking up of the past. Gus, the peacemaker, suggested that we leave everything as it is, and we wandered down to take a look at the hut among the boulders. A grim little place, squatting in its drifts of bones. The dogs didn't like it either. They nosed about edgily, then raced off along the beach to investigate our tent, which meant that Algy and Gus had to chase after them and tie them up. I went along to show willing, but they wisely didn't ask me to help. When we got back to the hut, Gus, the inveterate biologist, paused to identify the bones. Many are scattered, the disembodied skulls of walruses and reindeer, but others are recognizable skeletons. Gus pointed out foxes, fine and brittle as porcelain, and the big man-like frames of bears, and smaller ones with short limbs and long toes that look unsettlingly like human hands, which he said are seals. I tripped over a claim sign lying on the ground.
A posh one, of enameled tin, with emphatic capitals punched out in English, German and Norwegian. Property of the Spitsbergen Prospecting Company of Edinburgh. Claimed, 1905.
"And now there's nothing left," said Gus, chucking the sign away. The hut itself was about 6 feet square, a lean-to, with three walls of driftwood logs built against a large boulder, presumably to save on timber. The roof was still intact, tar paper dismally flapping, and the door was only 2 feet high, perhaps to keep in the heat. The side window had been smashed by a marauding bear, but the small one facing the sea was still shuttered. 3 paces in front of it stood a driftwood post, planted in a cairn of stones. Algy said it was a bear post, for luring bears to the trapper's gun. Gus took out his knife and prized the shutter off the front window, loosing a cascade of splintered glass. The old hut exhaled a musty smell of seaweed. Gus peered in. "I suppose we could use it for a doghouse. What do you think, Algy?" Algy shrugged.
"It's small. It's a pity to waste it."
He glanced at me.
"Want to take a look inside, Jack?"
I didn't, but I couldn't think of an excuse. I've never liked confined spaces, and as I crawled in after him, my spirit sank. The cries of gulls fell away. All I could hear was the wind keening in the stovepipe. The smell was thick in my throat, rotten seaweed and something else, as if something had crawled in here to die. The walls were black with soot, the ceiling too low to stand without stooping. In one corner, a rusty iron stove squatted on short, bowed legs. Against the back wall, a wooden bunk had collapsed beneath a mound of storm-blown debris. Rooting around, Algy found a mildewed reindeer hide and a battered tin plate. He wrinkled his nose.
"Beastly. Hopeless for the dogs."
He crawled out.
I stayed.
I don't know why.
For the first time since reaching Gruhooken, I thought about the men who were here before us, who built this hut from logs dragged up from the beach, and lived through the dark time and then left, leaving nothing but a tin plate and a blizzard of bones. What must it have been like? No wireless. Maybe not even a companion. At any rate, only one in a hut this size. To know that you're the only human being in all this wilderness. Moving to the front window, I scraped the broken glass off the frame and poked out my head. No sign of Algy or Gus. The bare post dominated the view. Beyond it, the stony beach sloped down to the sea. Suddenly, I felt desolate. It's hard to describe. An oppression. A wild plummeting of the spirits. The romance of trapping peeled away, and what remained was this. Squalor. Loneliness. It's as if the desperation of those poor men had soaked into the very timber, like the smell of blubber on the Isbjorn. I crawled out quickly and inhaled great gulps of salty air. I hate all this poring over ruins. I want Gruhugen to be ours. I don't want to be reminded that others were here before. 11th of August. I know I'm right. Whatever Mr. Bloody Erickson says. The ship got back as scheduled, and we spent 2 days unloading. Finished today, and would have made a start on the cabin if it hadn't been for him. While he was away, we decided on where to build it, which took about 5 minutes, this is completely bloody obvious. Where the old hut is, at the western end of the bay. It's conveniently near the stream, and the boulders give shelter from the winds off the ice cap, and it's far enough from the bird cliffs to ensure that my radio masts get decent reception. But oh no, none of that matters to old Erickson. As far as he's concerned, we need to be east, practically under the bloody cliffs. And we should leave the trapper's hut well alone. I think that's nonsense, I said. That hut's no use to man nor beast, it's got to come down.
No, Erickson said flatly.
Why? Said Gus. Erickson muttered something about the dogs.
I told you, Algy said wearily, it simply won't do for them.
Won't do for my wirelesses either, I said.
Erickson ignored that.
You're leaving the mining ruins alone. You should leave this too.
The mining ruins aren't in the way, I said. That hut most definitely is.
Not if you build the cabin further east, he said,
which brought us right back to where we'd started. It went on for hours. Eventually, he was forced to agree that it would be better if we didn't have to trudge the length of the bay to fetch water, but he remained adamant about not touching the hut. Algy gave in first, suggesting we use it as a storehouse. Then Gus conceded that maybe we could build our cabin alongside it. That's when I lost my temper. Did they want to preserve a ruin, or did they want wirelesses that actually work? But if I'm honest, I want that hut gone because I simply can't bear the thought of it. Some places drag you down, and that's one of them. Maybe it's the poverty and the loneliness, a reminder of what I came here to escape. Maybe I just don't like it. Anyway, I won. Next day. It's gone. Though we had the devil of a job tearing it down. For some reason, none of the crew wanted to touch it, so we had to pay them double, and Erickson had to have a stern word with them in Norwegian. They worked in sullen silence, and we helped, dragging the timbers away and chopping them up for firewood. Nothing's left of it now except for the bear post, which Algy told them to leave, as he wants to use it as a flagpole. I pointed out that we haven't got a flag, and he tapped the side of his nose and said, "Not yet." God, he can be irritating. Why Gus should regard him as his best pal, I've no idea. It's been an exhausting day. We turned in early. Gus and Algy are already asleep. Gus is frowning in his dreams. He looks young and noble, like the first officer over the top at the Somme. Algy is snoring. His thick red lips glisten with spit. An hour ago the weather broke, and a freezing wind came howling down from the ice cap. It's still blowing, sucking and smacking at the tent. The icebergs are grinding in the bay, and now and then one breaks apart with a crash. Erickson says that if this wind keeps up, it'll clear them away, so I suppose that's something. This evening, after dinner, when it was still calm, we strolled over to admire the site of our cabin. It's perfect. We've even cleared it of most of the bones. But I wish Algy hadn't kept that bloody post. Gruhuken seems to have had a dismal past. I don't want any of it poking through. And of course he had to go on about how the wretched thing works. Apparently it comes into its own in winter, when the pack ice gets near the coast and brings the bears. They're attracted to tall, standing things, especially with a slab of blubber dangling from the top. So all you've got to do is stay in your cabin with your rifle poking out of the window, and wait till a brute comes within range. I confess I'm rather keen to give it a shot. Algy, old man, said Gus, I don't think that's on. We don't want bears prowling around camp. He and Algy wandered off, amicably bickering, and I strolled down to the beach. Crossing the stream, I found my way onto the rocks. It was nearly midnight, and the great sloping pavements gleamed in that deep, gold, mysterious light. From a distance, they appear to shelve gently into the shadows, but in fact they end in a nasty 4-foot drop. The water's deep, and you can see right down to the bottom to huge green boulders and undulating weeds like drowned hair. Crouching at the edge, I watched the waves slapping, and the chunks of ice jostling and clinking. I heard that peculiar crackling as it talked to itself. I thought, if I fell in, I wouldn't be able to climb out. I'd try to swim round to where it's shallower, but the cold would get me long before then. As I was heading back, a shaft of sunlight struck the bear post. The wood was bleached silver except for a few charred patches and some darker blotches which must be blubber stains. I found it hard to believe it was once a tree in some Siberian forest. On impulse, I drew off my glove and laid my palm against it. It felt smooth and unpleasantly cold. I didn't like it. A killing post. And yet I think I now understand the impulse which drives men to shoot bears. It isn't for the pelt, or the meat, or the sport, or not only those things. I think they need to do it. They need to kill that great Arctic totem to give them some sense of control over the wilderness, even if that is only an illusion. Just now a shadow sped over the tent. I got such a fright I nearly cried out. Steady on, Jack, it was only a gull. The wind is blowing hard, and the dogs are howling. They're restless tonight. Chapter 6 15th of August. The cabin at Gruhuken. The cabin is finished, and we've moved in. It went up in 3 days, as everyone worked like Trojans, and it's beautiful. Black all over, walls covered in tar paper, roof in felt, with the stovepipe poking a little drunkenly from the top like the witch's hovel in Hansel and Gretel. The two front windows are such different sizes that they resemble mismatched eyes. Between them there's a small enclosed porch, above which Gus has nailed a pair of reindeer antlers. A nice, baronial touch. If you turn right and go round the corner, you find the outhouse, which Algy pompously calls the lavatory. At the rear, the eastern half of the cabin is backed by a lean-to of packing cases and wire netting for the dogs, while the western half abuts the boulders. The whole cabin is surrounded, except for the doghouse and the boulders, by a boardwalk about 2 feet wide. When you're inside and someone treads on this, you can hear the footsteps and feel the floor vibrate, as Algy is all too fond of demonstrating. My radio masts stand a few feet to the west, and beyond them is the Stevenson screen for the meteorological measurements. We've fenced that in to keep out the dogs and set a line of posts with ropes slung between them all the way to the porch, as Mr. Erickson says we'll need this in bad weather. The emergency storehouse is way off near the cliffs, and we've planted the dog stakes in front of the cabin so that we can keep an eye on them. Before we were even half unpacked, I ran a test on my wireless equipment. It works, thank God. My heart was in my mouth as I started the petrol engine for the big transmitter. When the valves began to glow, the sweat was pouring off me. Shakily, I tapped out our first message to England. It's childish, I know, but I did enjoy impressing the others. See? Good at it, aren't I? With headphones in place and the receiver switched on, I took down our first communication from the outside world. Message received, stop. We have 5 messages for you, stop. 1,700 miles through the ether and clear as a bell. The Times and the RGS. Hugo sportingly wishing us luck from Tromsø. Algy's girlfriend. Gus's parents and sister. Algy crassly asked why there was nothing for me, so I told him, parents dead, no siblings, no friends. I think he wishes he hadn't asked. The small Gambrel transmitter also works perfectly, as does the Eddystone receiver, which I got going in time for the BBC National programme. George Gershwin is dead, and the Japs have bombed Shanghai. It all seems very far away. Or it would have done if Algy hadn't blathered on about Mr. Hitler needing a jolly good thrashing. Gus told him sharply to shut up. He's like me. He doesn't want to think about another war. He told me the other day that he comes from a line of soldiers stretching back to Cressy, so the whole thing's rather hanging over him. Which you'd have thought Algy would have remembered, as he's known Gus since they were boys. Still, all that's over now, and we've been settling into our new home. It's 30 feet by 20, which sounds a lot, but is actually pretty cramped, as we've got so much equipment. When you enter the porch, you have to squeeze past a tangle of skis, snowshoes, shovels and brooms. Then, and I'm told this will be crucial in winter, you shut the front door before you open the one to the hall. Mr. Erickson calls this the first rule of the Arctic. Always shut one door before opening the next, especially in a blizzard. With that door shut behind you, you're in darkness, because the hall, which is narrow and extends along the frontage, has no window, only gun racks and hooks for waterproofs, and a cupboard which Gus calls his dark room. There's also a hatch into the roof space, which is our main food store. Having groped your way down the hall, you open the door to the bunk room, and fiat lux, a window. The bunk room occupies the eastern end of the cabin, and is mostly bunk, with shelves made of packing cases on the opposite wall. We only needed 3 bunks, but it was easier to build 4. I've got the bottom one at the back. The one above me is empty. We use it as a dumping ground. My bunk is nearest the stove in the main room, which is good, but it's got the doghouse directly behind. From my bunk you can see straight into the main room, as that doorway has no door. To your right, as you go in, there's the stove, water barrel, and shelves which make up the kitchen. No sink, of course. The main room is dominated by a big pine table and 5 chairs, and against the back wall are shelves crammed with books, ammunition, field glasses, microscopes and provisions. The western end of the cabin, on the site of the old trapper's hut, is my wireless area. It's packed with receivers and transmitters, the Austin engine, and the bicycle generator which faces the west window, so that I can see my wireless masts. My workbench is at the front, under the north window, overlooking the bear post. As the wireless area is farthest from the stove, is noticeably colder than the rest of the cabin, but that can't be helped. After hours of unpacking, we were too exhausted to cook a proper meal, so I made a big pot of scrambled eiderduck eggs. We bought a barrel from the crew who gather them in their thousands and ship them back to Norway. They're twice the size of hen's eggs, with shells of a beautiful speckled green, delicious, although with a lingering fishy tang. I can still smell it. I'm writing this at the main table by the glow of a tilly lamp. Outside it's light enough to read, but in here we need lamps, as much of the room is blind. There's only the small west window at the end, and the north one to the front. Before we lit the stove, we could see our breath in here, but it's warmed up now. We've left the stove door open, and the red glow is cheering. I can hear rain hammering on the roof and the wind moaning in the stovepipe. Yesterday, the weather turned squally. In the morning, the dog's water pails were coated with ice. When I remarked to Erickson that it's turning wintry, he laughed. He says that in Spitsbergen, winter doesn't begin until after Christmas. It's 8 o'clock, and we're safely inside for the night. I say night because although it's still light outside, it does feel like that. This evening, we saw the first faint stars. Gus and I are at one end of the table. I'm writing this journal, and Gus is smoking and doing his notes for the expedition report. At the other end of the table, Algy has set up the Singer treadle and is making dog harnesses. He's whistling some inane tune, and when he's not whistling, he's breathing noisily through his mouth. So what with Algy and the treadle, it isn't exactly quiet, added to which there's the noise from the dogs. They're all related to each other, which is supposed to minimize fights, but you wouldn't think so, to judge by what's coming from the doghouse. Growls, snarls, yelps, scrabblings and gnawings, bouts of oo-oo-oos. When it gets too loud, we shout and bang on the wall, and they subside into hard done-by whines. As usual, Mr. Erickson and the crew have gone back to the ship to sleep. It's their last night at Gruhooken, and I get the impression that they're relieved. Tomorrow, we're giving a lunch in Mr. Erickson's honour. Then we'll say a fond farewell to the Isbjorn and be on our own. Later. I've moved to my bunk because Algy is using his collapsible safari bath, and I'd rather not watch. All that wobbly, freckled flesh. His feet are the worst. They're flat, pink slabs, and the second and third toes protrude way beyond the big toe, which I find repulsive. Gus saw me staring at them, and flushed. No doubt he's embarrassed for his best pal. Sometimes, though, I wonder why I'm finding it quite so hard to tolerate Algy. Maybe it's because we're so cramped in here. We're all getting hairier and dirtier, and the cabin smells of wood smoke and unwashed clothes. You've got to duck under lines of drying socks and pick your way between the gear. Algy's simply making it worse. He never puts anything away, and every morning he shakes out his sleeping bag and leaves it draped over the bunk to air. I never thought I'd say this, but I'm quite glad that we didn't get rid of the dogs. Of course, I still don't like them. And that's not going to change, despite Gus's best efforts. Yesterday he tried to introduce me to his favourite, a scrawny russet bitch named Oopik. She fawns on him, but when I approached she growled. I shrugged it off, but he was disappointed, with Oopik, and maybe also with me. "I don't know why she did that," he said. "You're not afraid of her, I can tell." "No," I said, "but I don't particularly like her either. I bet she senses that." He looked so downcast that I laughed. "Oh, give up, Gus. You'll never make me a dog lover." Right now I can hear them yowling and scratching at the wall behind my bunk. To my surprise, I don't mind the sound at all. In fact, I like it. It's reassuring to know that just behind my head on the other side of this wall there are living creatures, even if they are dogs. 16th of August. Midnight. First dark. The Isbjorn has finally gone, and we're on our own. My lamp casts a little pool of yellow light, and beyond it are shadows. Just now I went to the north window. I saw the lamp's golden reflection in the panes, which are dark blue and spangled with frost. When I cupped my hands to the glass and peered out, I saw a sprinkling of stars in an indigo sky and the charcoal line of the bear post. Nothing is wrong, but I want to set down what happened this afternoon, to get it straight in my mind. Around noon, some of the crew rowed ashore. We gave them a crate of beer as a thank you. They've worked hard, even if it was because they're desperate to leave and get in a few weeks' sealing before the winter. Then we had lunch with Mr. Erickson. Guessing that he'd appreciate a change from ship food, we gave him tinned ox cheek and curried vegetables with Bengal chutney, followed by Californian pears and Singapore pineapple, then fries, chocolate and coffee. He enjoyed it immensely, although at first he seemed intimidated by the Royal Dalton. But then Gus opened two bottles of claret and a box of cigars, and he became quite jolly. Told us how to make the trapper's speciality, blood pancakes, and gave us advice on getting through the dark time.
Walk every day. Keep a routine. Don't think too much.
He added that if we ever get into difficulty, there's a friend of his, an experienced trapper called Niels Bjørvik, overwintering on Vidafjord, 20 miles to the west. He made quite a point about that. Then he surprised us by producing 3 jars of pickled cloudberries, which he says are the best thing for warding off scurvy. He scoffs at the notion of vitamin C and thinks our Redoxon tablets are a waste of money. I was touched. I think the others were, too. After lunch, the crew still had a couple of hours' work to do assembling our German Klepper canoes. Gus went down to the beach with Erickson to take photographs, and Algy cleaned up the lunch things as per our rota. To clear my head of cigar fumes, I went for a walk. I headed upstream past the mining ruins, and at first the ground was a springy carpet of dwarf willow and moss. I walked fast, and was soon sweating. That's something I'm still getting used to, having to gauge how many layers to put on. Mr. Erickson told us a Norwegian saying, "If you're warm enough when you set out, you're wearing too many clothes." As I climbed higher, the going got tougher. I found myself stumbling over naked scree and brittle black lichen. The wind was sharp, and I was soon chilled. Clouds obscured the ice cap, but I felt its freezing breath. When I took off my hat, my skull began to ache within seconds. Behind the hiss of the wind and the chatter of the stream, the land lay silent. I passed the skeleton of a reindeer. I came to a standing stone by a small, cold lake. I stopped. I was aware of the noises around me, the wind, the water, my panting breath, but somehow they only deepened the stillness. I felt it as a physical presence. Immense. Overwhelming. I realized that this place is, and always will be, no man's land. I suppose it's to be expected that Gruhuken should make me a little uneasy from time to time. After all, I'm town-bred, not used to the wild. But... to stand on that slope and know that there's nothing to the west of you until Greenland, nothing to the east except the Arctic Ocean, nothing to the north until the North Pole, and that's just more nothing. With a jolt, I realized I'd forgotten my gun.
I thought of bears and started back, irked that I'd made such a basic mistake. I'd come further than I'd intended, and below me, our camp looked like a child's toy, dwarfed by the prehistoric curves of the whalebones on the shore. Out in the bay, the Isbjorn was tiny. The sky was a strange, sickly yellow. The sun was sinking into the sea. In a few minutes, for the first time, it would disappear. In the bay, an oar flashed. A rowing boat was taking a party of men back to the ship. I would have to hurry, or I'd miss saying goodbye to Ericsson. Twilight came on as I scrambled over the stones. The wind dropped to a whisper. I heard the creak of my anorak, my laboring breath. I was still 500 yards above camp when I saw a man standing in front of the cabin by the bear post. His back was turned, but I could tell it wasn't Algy or Gus. It must be one of the crew, taking a last look at the cabin he had helped to build. The sun was in my eyes, but I made out that he wasn't dressed like a sealer. Instead of overalls, he wore a tattered sheepskin coat and a round cap. Ragged boots. I called out to him, "Hello there! You better get down to the boats, or you'll be left behind." He turned to face me, a dark figure against the glare. Fleetingly, I saw that his hands were at his sides, and that one shoulder was higher than the other. There was something about the tilt of his head that I didn't like. He didn't make an agreeable impression. All right, he made a disagreeable one. I wanted him away from my camp and safely heading for the ship, and irrationally I wished I hadn't drawn attention to myself by calling out to him. Feeling foolish, I continued down the slope. I had to watch my footing. When I looked again, I was relieved to see that the man had gone. Some time later, when I reached the shore, Mr. Ericsson was at the water's edge, waiting with the last of his crew to say goodbye. There was no sign of Algy or Gus, and the men seemed nervous, glancing over their shoulders at the vanishing sun. I didn't see anyone in a sheepskin coat, so I mentioned the straggler to Mr. Ericsson. He looked at me sharply, then back to his men. Taking my arm, he drew me aside. "You make a mistake," he said in a low voice. "There was no one at the cabin." I snorted. "Well, but there was, you know. That's all right, he's obviously gone in the other boat." Scowling, Ericsson shook his head. It occurred to me that he thought I might be accusing one of his men of loitering with intent to pilfer, so I said quickly, "It doesn't matter, I only mentioned it so he doesn't get left behind." I gave an awkward laugh. "After all, we'd rather not have an uninvited guest making a fourth with us in the cabin." Ericsson didn't seem to like that. Brusquely, he asked if I'd spoken to the man. I told him no, except to urge him to hurry up and join his fellows, which clearly he had. The Norwegian opened his mouth to reply, but just then Gus and Algy came running down, bearing our parting gift of claret and cigars, so he lost his chance. Algy and Gus made embarrassed little speeches of thanks, and Ericsson reddened and thanked them back. His manner was strained. I don't think they noticed. When it was my turn, he took my hand and crushed it in his bear's grip. "Good winter, Professor," he said, his grey eyes holding mine. At the time, I couldn't make out his expression. But now I wonder if it wasn't pity. Then he was in the boat, and his men were pushing off. As it rocked over the waves, he glanced back, not at us, but behind us, to the cabin. I couldn't help doing the same. All I saw were the dogs yowling and straining at their stakes. The three of us stood and watched the boat reach the Isbjorn. We watched the men climb on board. We watched them raise the boat. We heard the sputter of the engine as the ship gathered speed.
By now, all that remained of the sun was a crimson slash on the horizon. Suddenly, Algy clapped his hand to his forehead, then turned and raced up the beach. When he reached the bear post, he hoisted the flag he'd almost forgotten, a dead fulma which he'd shot that morning. He strung it up by one wing, and the wind caught it and made it flap, a parody of flight. Out in the bay, the Isbjorn dipped her ensign in reply. As the sun's dying glimmer turned the sea to bronze, we watched the ship disappear behind the headland.
"And then there were three," said Algy. Gus made no reply. I repressed a movement of irritation. "Stay there," Algy commanded. Running back to the cabin again, he swiftly returned with his camping canteen, two crystal bottles of whiskey and water with three